Welcome to Come Inside. Today's guests are Denise Huskins and Aaron Quinn. Usually what I would do is give you a bit of a rundown about what this episode is about, but I'm going to do it a little differently today, and I'm going to just allow Denise and Aaron to tell their story in their own words. If you want to know more about the story that you're about to hear, Denise and Aaron, along with Nicole Egan, have written a book about Denise and Aaron's experiences. It's called Victim F, From Crime Victims to Suspects to Survivors. Like I said, I'm not going to sit here and give you a whole spiel about this episode. We're just going to jump straight into it. So thanks for listening. I hope you like this episode. Here it is, my interview with Denise Huskins and Aaron Quinn. Enjoy. I won't start exactly at March 23rd, or early in the morning, but had either of you noticed anything strange or odd happening before that day? Or was everything just kind of normal?
No, I mean, there's a lot of things in hindsight you look back on and you're like, okay, that makes sense. There's a lot of, you know, just more deep feeling suspicions. Is someone watching us? But, you know, you always just kind of like brush those aside and think why and who and that, you know, how it's rare. And so you rationalize that whatever your fears are, it's just unvalidated paranoia. But then you realize it's true.
Yeah. I mean, I actually write about in the book is that I was feeling paranoid the week before. Actually, I told my mom that I thought someone was watching me. Wow. And the months prior to the kidnapping, I few times remember coming home and feeling like someone had been in my house. And then I would look around, nothing was stolen. So you kind of go like, well, maybe I'm just making up things. But also my security system had started acting erratically. And even as I tried to troubleshoot it and I would call the company, they couldn't find out anything wrong with it. I now believe that the kidnappers probably put up some sort of, you know, potentially metal or something that could have blocked the signal from the front door, because that was pretty much what they thought. They're like, they kept on asking me, did you install something? Did you put something new? I was like, no, nothing's changed. Now knowing that they were preparing for this for about 6 months.
Yeah. Wow. What was it when you'd come home that made you think someone's been in my home, even though nothing's missing? Was it just that feeling of something just doesn't feel right? Like something's out of place, but you're not 100% sure what?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So I would come home and just kind of feel like something's been disturbed. It was more of an energy thing. And then I would, and I remember specifically coming home one day and combing through my house and going like, nothing is out of place that I could remember. But I'm like, someone's been in here. And then there's something to put a finger on. So you're just kind of going like, I don't know what to say about. Cause
you can't report that.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, a suspicion. Yeah.
And there had been break-ins at people's homes. Now we know that the kidnappers group, they were stealing stuff from people's houses. But they were coming in discreetly. So I would, double check if all my windows were locked. And again, it's like, you think if someone's going to break in during the day, they would steal something, not just break in. And obviously they were planning on getting into the Wi-Fi or plotting out how they're going to organize this home invasion.
Yeah. So it's March 23rd of 2015. It's around 3 a.m. and you're woken up. Is one of you woken up first? And what was it that initially woke you up?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if we both woke up around the same time or not. I was definitely in a deep sleep, and there was a moment before really waking up where I was hearing a strange man's voice. And it felt like my subconscious knew that there was something not quite right and wasn't letting me wake up. But eventually I couldn't resist, and I was forced awake because, the man's voice just kept saying, this is a robbery, wake up. We're not here to hurt you. And I was turned away from where the voice was speaking, away from Aaron, and just my eyes shot open and I saw flashing white light against the wall and red laser dots spanning the wall. And eventually he told us both to lay face down. And I turned and Aaron didn't move. So I wasn't sure if he was awake yet or if he was just in shock. And eventually the voice speaking said, "Aaron, you're laying face up, lie face down." And that was, you know, one of the many instances where throughout the night, it was just, you realize how much planning was going into this. They knew Aaron's name, and it was really well planned out and well organized.
Yeah. How scary is it when you realize, Aaron, that they know your name?
Yeah. To Denise's point, it was clear that this had been planned and they had the jump on us. You know, they had guns facing us. There was a taser. When that happens, you just go, how do I limit the damage? And basically my first thought was just don't physically hurt us and hopefully don't rape Denise. And yeah, you're in complete helplessness and you're just trying to get through it. And, you know, they're saying it's a robbery. You hope it's a robbery. They obviously could take anything they want. I just want us to be safe. And I mean, it's a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. And it gets worse from here, doesn't it? So how many people were there?
We don't know for sure, but before, because they had instructed me to tie up Aaron's hands and feet together with zip ties and then instructed me to walk to the closet. And so I had my head down because they said, you know, keep your head down, don't look up. And as I passed by the bed, I saw two people's legs standing there. It looked like they were all in black at attention, but I only saw up to waist level. And it looked like they were holding something, which I assumed to be the guns where the red laser dots were coming from. And when we were in the closet, we also could hear a lot of noise downstairs when the one man who was speaking was upstairs still with us. He was like rummaging through a bag and getting recording devices and headphones for us to listen to. And we could hear on opposite ends of the downstairs, there was drawers opening. There was a drill running, 40 feet away from it. So we believe there's at least three people based on what we heard and what we saw.
Yeah. Wow. So there's a lot going on. It's quite amazing you were able to kind of almost take that in because you would have been in so much shock.
Yeah. There's a extreme balance of being completely terrified and feeling this overwhelming panic and adrenaline pumping. But then at the same time, you are telling yourself to stay calm because you have to be as lucid and clear as possible to take in any bit of information because you don't know what is going to save your life. So we were just listening to anything we could to anticipate, okay, if he's up here, how many other people are there? Like you're really trying to figure out the probability of anything you can do to save your life. Can I run? Can I fight? Can I scream? What is any of that going to do other than make things worse for our situation? And Aaron and I weren't talking to each other because, we were being threatened. We didn't want to provoke them, but we were both processing things and making the same decisions. There was kind of this unspoken energy between us that was like, we both knew that it was in our best interest to comply to mitigate the damage.
Yeah. And I think it's important to note too, that they woke us up with the voice saying, we're this is a robbery, but this wasn't paced at like a bum rush. And there was, it was methodical what they were doing. So, and there was many times where we're left alone in the closet or by ourselves for long periods of time. And it's quiet. So you can hear everything going on in the home. I also thought about us being in the medical field. I have been in medical emergencies. I've had to do chest compressions on people who are potentially dying or that person actually did pass away. So we've had experiences in these high pressure situations where you are internally panicking, but then you use your breath, you calm yourself down, you focus and try to just get through as best you can. It's unfortunate, like what was used against us was the fact that we remembered things, and that was proof by the police that we made up this, fabricated this whole story. Even though you're during time, you're trying to one, save your life, and two, hopefully give the police information, as much information as possible. Yeah. So that's a real dangerous game that they play as a subjective, details.
Yeah. Oh yeah. We'll get into them. Don't you worry. Cause, can't, yeah. And it, we'll get there. Don't worry. But so I know you mentioned they did put headphones on the both of you at one point, and they were playing pre-recorded messages to you.
Yes.
What were these messages?
Well, there was multiple ones. The first one was this kind of like a whim chime music that with an odd-tuned voice saying, stay calm, this is a robbery, this is not your fault. It kind of repeated those lines. Eventually it said that a medical professional was going to come in and check our vitals, which ended up just being the voice. And then there was also messages once we were separated that were telling us that we would should, if we stayed in the same, or if we answered questions correctly, we would stay in the room together. That'd be like our quote reward. But however, at that time we were separated. So we kind of knew something wasn't going to their plan. And at one point, there's another message where they play for me, which is about a 10-minute message where they give all this detail about their group being a black market company that people could hire for personal or financial debts, and kind of giving my instructions of what I need to do over the next 48 hours. So it's the whole home invasion from the time they woke us up to the time they took Denise was about 2 hours. And throughout that, I think I heard probably four different messages.
Wow. Wow. And at what point did you realize that they were there for you, Aaron, but they were actually there for your ex-girlfriend, which also just happened to have long blonde hair like you, Denise? At what point do you realize that?
Yeah, they had separated us, put Denise in a different room, and I was still in my master closet. Then the voice came back and he said, we have a problem. Or he asked, does my ex and Denise look alike? And I said, yes. They both have long blonde hair. And he said, we got the wrong intel. We got to see what we're going to do next. And that was probably, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 minutes from when they woke us up. From there was he was gone for at least 20 minutes. There was a long silence. I was actually hoping that they had left because it was so quiet. But unfortunately, then I could hear him talking with Denise, and they came back, and then they told us that they were going to continue to take Denise for 48 hours because this was a practice run for their group, and this would allow them to test their protocols so that they could target someone who had more money than me.
Yeah. Wow. So then, yeah, Denise, you're told you're going to be moved to a second location for 48 hours while you, Aaron, have to do these tasks. What's going through your mind when you're told that you are going to be moved from, even though you probably don't feel safe, but you feel somewhat safer being there in that home with Aaron, all of a sudden you're going to be taken out of there?
Yeah, I think at that point, I was just in shock and complete hopelessness and despair of what does this mean for me? And is this, as soon as they take me from here, is this the beginning of the end of my life? But I'm sitting there with my hands and feet bound. I feel the sedative starting to kick in. I'm blindfolded with these blackout swim goggles, and there's nothing I could do. So it was just waiting to see what was in store for me.
Yeah. Sorry, we actually skipped that part. You were forced to take sedative. You were drugged.
Right. Yeah. And in the first recording, when Aaron had said, in the recording, it said that there was a medic professional who was going to come take our vitals and then give us a sedative. And okay, we would either have to take it orally, or if we chose not to, then they would inject it intravenously. So again, it was just, step by step, all these very specific ways to corner us and make us completely defenseless.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it was so well planned out. It's unlike any robbery that you've ever heard of before. What were those tasks that they wanted you to complete, Aaron?
Primarily was to get money. So they had already knew how much money I had in my checking account. They knew my where I banked at, my credit cards. They also knew where I had my 401k. So he also, the voice, as we call him in the book, asked what bills I had to pay. At the time, I had about $20,000 in my checking account. So they ended up telling me that they wanted two payments of $8,500 to avoid the $10,000 mandatory reporting limit. So they were basically trying to get as much money as I could give them without, I guess, like, you know, ruining my life or making me have to go to outside sources.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would have given up any amount of money. I just, you know, I could easily access what I have. So it shows, again, the planning or a little bit of their intelligence of keeping it self-contained is you ask for an amount that I could access easily. You don't ask for if I go into my 401k, there's more paper trail, if I all these other reasons. So that was another part of like them planning out well. And they mentioned this before, but one of the things when the voice had separated Denise and I, he came back into the closet and told he said, "You grew up and named my parents' address." So that was chilling because my parents still live there and also show that they had really stalked me, which they had, and yeah, were very specific towards me.
Yeah. Wow. That's so creepy that they would know where you've grown up as well. Just so well planned out. They tell you, Aaron, that if you call the police, they will kill Denise. What was your thought process that you had to go through before you made that decision that you need to call the police? Because, I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah, the long recording that I mentioned talked about that they were going to have me stay in my living area. The drill that we heard was actually the camera that they were putting up. Yep. So that they could monitor me. And then they also said they put a mirroring app on my phone. So they would see if I called or text anyone and they could, and I had to stay within these red lines. Otherwise they would punish Denise. When the voice brought me downstairs, as they had already put Denise in my car, there was this electronic dung, dung, dung sound coming from the camera. And I had asked the voice if it was going to make that sound the entire time, because I could already tell that was going to drive me insane. And he had mentioned that they couldn't get into my router and they were loading it through the Wi-Fi and that sound just stopped by the morning. So they take Denise, the sedatives kick in, and I'm passed out till basically midday. Once I'm finally able to overcome the effects of the sedatives, that camera's still making that noise. And through my communications with the kidnappers, I start to realize that they probably can't see me, because a variety of reasons, I determined that the camera isn't fully operating and I need to take the chance of calling the police. Actually, I called my brother, who's an FBI special agent, and he's one, because I thought that if they saw that I called my brother, I could lie and to say my brother was supposed to come over and I was redirecting him. You can't really lie about, you know, calling 911. But he told me to call the police because the kidnappers tend to threaten most of the time, but they won't fall through. We need the full force of law enforcement involved. And that was, you know, the most difficult decision I've ever made. For me, it was because I knew if I called the police, I'm going to be safe, or at least I thought it would be safe. And I could be killing Denise because they could see. So, but in turn, you can't trust people who break into your home and kidnap someone. And the alternative was to show up with the money and they could have taken me and killed both of us and there'd be no witnesses. So I couldn't trust them. I decided to trust the police instead.
Yeah. So obviously, you call the police, they arrive to your home, and everything looks a little suspicious to them because Denise, your car, and the bedspread are all missing, and you are in possession of Denise's phone. So I could see from the outside how that would look suspicious, but I also kind of think, why would you be calling the police saying that she's been kidnapped and then you wouldn't cover your tracks? Like, it's so it doesn't, it's kind of stupid that they would think that it was you. But so you're then taken to the police station, right, to give a statement. At what point do you realize I'm in trouble here? They're like, they're not believing me. They, you know, I've seen some of the interrogation videos and stuff like that. He wanted you to say what he thought was the truth, but you were telling the truth, but it was just such a wild story.
Yeah, I mean, I always knew the police would look at me as a potential suspect because I'm the last person to see Denise. And it is a kind of bizarre scene that it came into my house. But there's also like a mountain of evidence that the kidnappers left, like the camera, like a portable phone charger, things that weren't in my possession, yeah. That I hadn't even touched, that actually the police just left at my house. So I figured foolishly that the police might just follow the evidence and that the evidence would clear me because I didn't do anything. Also, there's emails and text messages from the kidnappers that I assumed that they could track. When I'm initially there, they're just asking general open-ended questions. I'm answering them and I'm giving them access to my phone, access to my emails, pretty much anything they ask for, I'm like, have it. The first sign that was when they took my clothes for evidence, they put me in prison clothes. Literally said Solano County Prison on the side. And, you know, they gave excuse that that's all they had. So I just took them for a word. But it wasn't until I talked to Detective Matt Mustard, and that was about 4 hours into when I got into the police station. And he questioned me for about 45 minutes, kind of going over the exact same things I had told the previous detectives. And then he tells me, you know, I don't believe you. And this, what you said happened didn't happen, and you killed her, and for more or less. This is a common tactic by police. It's actually how they get trained. So they put you, isolate you from your family, isolate you from pretty much anyone. And they give you two choices, and your choices are you did it by accident. And if it's an accident, I can help you, which is, when they say that, they are completely fucking lying. If you keep saying what that you didn't do it, we're going to paint you as a cold, calculated monster.
Yeah.
That's why people falsely confess, because they're psychologically torturing you and you just want it to stop.
Oh, 100%. And him even bringing up, you know, Lacey Peterson and obviously her husband, Scott Peterson, it was quite random, like very random that he was like, I can, you know, he was talking about how much he hates that guy and he can paint you out to be exactly like that.
It's also important. He asked me about it and he says that he doesn't even know much about the case, but that guy's a lying son of a bitch. And he's like, he fully admits that he doesn't know really any of the details or any of the evidence, but he knows that guy's lying and that's what he's going to do to me. Actually, throughout this whole time, I get interrogated for 18 hours. I go, even go back to the police station the next day after every detective who questioned me or FBI agent questioned me never went to my house, and none of them had actually evaluated any evidence prior to questioning me.
Yeah.
They just knew I was lying.
Knew you were lying, which is, So, well, this is the next tactic that police often use, and a lot of people don't realize that it's kind of stupid, but you agreed to take a polygraph test. They're inadmissible in court and they're actually easy to cheat, essentially. They're not conclusive at all. But so you take one, and I can understand why you would agree to do that at that time. I mean, you've been drugged with a sedative, you're sleep deprived, you have no idea if Denise is dead or alive. So you're just like, you're cooperating and you're doing whatever. But then you're told by the FBI agent who conducted that test that you failed miserably. which I'm not sure if that's actually true that you failed, but I'm assuming you probably didn't, but they tell you that because they want you to then give them something. What goes through your mind at that point? Do you think I'm crazy? Did I do something to her? Do I not remember? Do I? Because this is what they do, right? They plant that seed of doubt to make you go, hang on, I need to question everything that I know is true and real.
Yeah, so they present the polygraph. This, I'll take a step back.
Yep.
This is why you should never talk to the police without a lawyer, because they present the polygraph. And if I said no, that would be a sign of guilt to them.
Yeah.
So you're basically put in a situation where you have to say yes, and they know that. I didn't fail the polygraph. They actually, to tell you how much they cared about the results of it, in the affidavit, it says the polygraph's results are unknown. So they didn't even bother evaluating them.
Of course.
Polygraphs are just complete and utter crap. They're useless. They're FBI agent Peter French was going to, he was going to say, I failed no matter what. And that's what they do. They're just using it as a prop, and it's a whole charade going on. Professor is an expert in police interrogations, has watched over thousands of interrogations, and he's never seen a person ever pass a polygraph once the police are interrogating, because they don't care what the answer is. It's just to make you feel like there's this magic box that can tell you if you're the truth or not. But it does make you question reality. You know, people who are, insane don't think they're insane. But if every person who's telling you did this, and they're gaslighting you over and over with tremendous pressure, and they're trained, they're really effective at doing it. There was times where I was like, did I actually do something? And then I realized, well, where did I get a camera? If I had this psychotic break, how was I able to accumulate all this equipment in a short period of time in the middle of the night? And it's devastating. It still haunts me to this day.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely terrible, because they obviously believe that you've murdered Denise at this point, because there's no proof that Denise is alive. But then in a really odd turn of events, the San Francisco Chronicle has sent a voice recording of you, Denise, where you are saying that you're being kidnapped. So before we go too far forward from that, we've obviously heard kind of from Aaron's point of view what he went through. What did you go through from the moment that you're taken from Aaron's home? Because I'm assuming the bedspread's with you. You were probably wrapped in it and put into the boot of Aaron's car.
Yeah. Lined the bottom of Aaron's trunk with a comforter to make me more, quote, comfortable. And then I was shaking from fear and cold, and I asked for a blanket, and he got me a blanket. And eventually, you know, he closes the trunk and we pull out, and I am struggling to breathe. I'm wondering if I'm going to be killed from suffocating in this trunk, and I'm trying not to panic. And we drive at least 20 minutes, maybe more, and he switches me from that trunk to a different trunk that was much smaller, more crammed, but I could breathe easier. And so it made me wonder too if it was one of those sports cars that the back seat pulls down to get access to the trunk, and he could keep an eye on me.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm in and out of consciousness for several hours, and eventually the car slows down. He parks, pulls me out of the trunk, and leaves me on what I assumed to be a garage floor. It was cold concrete, and he had to go inside to clean, he said, and I could hear him scrubbing what sounded like a bathtub and tile floor, and just crazy thoughts were going through my mind, and any horror film I've ever seen, and just wondering what they really want. You know, he never really specifically said we're going to get money from Aaron. I think he always kept it vague. Like, yeah, you know, we're asking Aaron to complete these tasks, but you know, I'm wondering if this is all just like some sick game that they're going to make us perform and use each other against each other, and that they were really just in it to just horribly torture us. And I was just preparing for the worst.
And hearing them scrubbing something that sounds like tiles in a bathtub, I can't imagine what's going through your mind in that point. Like, I mean, you know, I study crime. So, I mean, I've seen so many documentaries where, you know, someone might be killed in a bathtub because it's easier to kind of maybe clean it up, or they think it is, or whatever it is. I mean, I can't imagine what must have been going through your mind. That's horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, I was just imagining him just cleaning up just bloody remains of a prior victim, and he was just setting up the scene for me. You know, and so I was anticipating the worst, and then oddly, there was this continued politeness and this handling of me with care when he, you know, cut the zip ties off and helped me walk into the house, and he had me shower, and he closed the door to give me privacy, he said, because he didn't want to dehumanize me any more than he already had to. And it was, you know, at first it was jarring and it was hard to process because it was complete contradiction of the situation I was in. But it became clear that it was a tactic to keep me as calm as possible. So I'll continue to comply and reduce the risk of me fighting or screaming or trying to run.
Could you see his face, or were they covered?
Were they? I never had an opportunity to even see, you know, above waist level. Yeah. From when I left the bed, walking to the closet, that was the only time I was able to see really bodies. But I didn't try to look up, so I don't know if they were wearing a mask or anything. And then I always had those blacked out swim goggles on when he was in the room with me.
Of course.
Eventually, he, after the first time he raped me, he allowed me to have the goggles off when I was in a room alone, but he would knock upon entry and have me look away and put the goggles on. And so he was training me.
Yeah. Wow. I hope this isn't too, it's all right if you don't want to answer this question. How many times were you raped?
I was raped twice. So the first rape, of course, that's not what he called it. He had come in later that first afternoon to say that since they got the wrong intel and I am not the intended target, they didn't have any information on me. So they needed to have one of them have sex with me so they could record it and it would be used against me if they thought that I would go to the police. Yeah. So if they thought that I was going to go to the police, then they would release it on the internet. And so it would have to look like, you know, a porn film or something that was, well, not a rape. And the first time I saw the swim goggles on and I just laid there limp and detached and hoped that it would just end as soon as possible. And there was a point during where I was like, this isn't the last time they're going to do this. The next day, he said it didn't look believable enough. And he was in contact with his associates is what he called them. And they said that it needed to look like we were having an affair, that we were in some kind of relationship, and that this was also going to be used potentially be against the man holding me captive to where his associates could potentially send it to his fiance, because he said he just proposed to someone a couple weeks before that, and it would have to look like he was cheating on her. And they did this as a way to make sure that he would stay on task, to, you know, in case he decided to have a change of heart and release me before they wanted him to.
God, every detail is just so planned out by these people. That's just crazy. I'm so sorry that happened to you. I think that's disgusting. I'm really sorry. That was really, I'm sure that's very hard for you to talk about, and for you, Aaron, also to hear that again and again. I'm so sorry that happened to you. It's disgusting. So I guess we can jump forward just a little bit, but so this proof of life recording that appears or is received by eventually the police from the San Francisco Chronicle. So Aaron, you're called back to the police station when they get that right. What happens next?
I go to the police station. There's an FBI hostage negotiator there, which I took as a positive sign that they maybe are taking this serious now. In turn, he says he's catching up and he wants to ask me a few more questions. And this is now over 24 hours since I've called the police. I don't know what he was doing the previous 24 hours, but obviously not evaluating the case. And so they make me go through all the details again. And this is the fourth time I've done it. There was one agent there who was actually asking intelligent questions. So I thought he potentially believed me, and maybe they're asking a little bit more about certain wording and stuff to try to figure out a profile type that they're searching for. After, I don't know, gosh, I've been there 3 hours at this point, they finally give me a computer and my phone back, which I've had in possession since I've called the police the day before. I started looking, I have a bunch of text messages and missed calls, and then my lawyer's paralegal recognizes that my phone's on airplane mode. And I take off, they tell me to take off airplane mode, and then it just floods with more text messages and emails or voicemails to where it basically maxes out. And then when I log into my email account, which the kidnappers have been communicating, I see that the kidnappers had sent emails saying that they were going to call me the day before around 9 p.m. And that those emails have been opened, and that the only people could open those were the police. And during that time, the police had put my phone in airplane mode and didn't track any of the phone calls.
When I read that your phone was put on airplane mode, I was like, that can't be true. I'm like, that is bizarre. Like, you're saying that she's been kidnapped. Even if they think that you're the murderer, which they obviously did or whatever, why would you put the phone on airplane mode? Absolutely bizarre. They're very lucky that Denise wasn't killed, because
they did everything they could to try to get her killed.
Seriously.
Even they put her name out there. They put a picture out there, I had told the police, hey, they said they'll kill Denise if I go to you guys. And then they put her all across the news.
Yeah.
It's broadcasting the kidnappers that I've gone to the police. I remember when I saw that my phone, that the kidnapper said that they were calling, and this is basically during that exact same time, the day before Detective Musters tell me that the kidnappers have not tried to communicate, not once. And almost to the exact same moment, the kidnappers were calling my phone, and they did not track those phone calls until 24 hours later, which did lead them. They triangulated 3 calls to South Lake Tahoe, which they never went up to. And later we find out that's where Denise was held. So they actually had evidence at the time, actively did not follow it, actually made it harder to follow. And then once they obtained the evidence, they ignored that completely. And I literally saw red. I understand that saying. Red filled my whole vision. The simplest thing, if they thought I was lying, is just to go along with it, and my story would have fallen apart within a few minutes. If the kidnappers say they're going to call, how many answer the phone? If the kidnappers aren't on the phone, then I'm maybe guilty. They actually just made themselves way more work. And I mean, like, I guess I'll take the compliment that they think I'm smart enough to make this all up, but that's a real lot of balls to juggle. It's just ludicrous thought process. And this is how they railroad people, is that unfortunately you're at the mercy of what they decide is evidence and what they decide is important. So if they decide pieces like phone calls aren't evidence, you can't do much about it.
Yeah, no. What can you do? Which is just pathetic, because that's why they're there, right? That's what we're told to believe. They're there to serve and protect, but it doesn't seem to work that way with all of them.
Time for a quick break now. You're listening to Come Inside.
Hey, listeners, I just wanted to jump in here really quickly to tell you about my new movement. It's called Be the Change Movement. What I've learned over my life so far is that we seem to be a little bit more interested in listening to what people say so that we can respond, instead of actually sitting back and listening to understand what they're saying. For me, life is about evolving, and we cannot evolve if we do not educate ourselves. And that is what Be the Change Movement is all about. Head to killereducation.com, click on the shop tab, read about the movement, and also we have t-shirts, hoodies, hats, beanies, we even have some baby clothes available as well, with more things to be released soon. Proceeds from the sales of the Be the Change merchandise will go towards the development of a creative arts rehabilitation program for incarcerated juveniles, as well as resources to fight wrongful convictions. Together we can create change. So take the pledge to be the change the world needs. Head to killereducation.com. Now let's get back to the podcast.
It's interesting that they traced those calls and they had figured out kind of an area where Denise may have been held, and they just completely ignored that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's also a thing, the brand name's called Stingray, but it's a cell phone site simulator. So once you know where the cell tower that calls are being made, you can actually bring this equipment out and it will locate a phone within like a foot. And the FBI had that with them, or had it in Sacramento in the area. They could have used it. It's a really troublesome technology. But the FBI even advertises like, we can use it during a kidnapping. So they could have gone up and found Denise, or if they thought we were making up, which now I know that they believe the kidnapping was a hoax during at that time.
Yeah.
They could have found Denise. Someone's making those calls, and they could have even found Denise on the other end. And then you would have proof that was a hoax. So pretty much everything they did didn't help them in any direction, even if we're telling the truth or if we're lying. It did not help them solve any case. It was just tunnel vision.
Yeah, it was just speculation, right? You're right. Because they really didn't follow any lead to figure out anything. Because you're right, if they go up to follow where Denise may be, well, they're going to figure out, is it for real or is this a hoax? But they just...
Yeah, and the things that they did spend resources on made no sense. They had divers in the water in the middle of the night after a proof of life was sent. You know, my dad was seeing this on the news and had spoken to them hours before, and he's like, and heard the proof of life. He's like, why are they looking for a body if I just went in there and confirmed that proof of life was in fact my daughter? Yeah. What's going on? And an officer called him. He's like, oh, don't worry about that. So, you know, fast forward to when I'm released and they say on national news it's a hoax and we've wasted valuable resources.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what were they doing?
Yeah. And there's that point where I think it was the lieutenant who came out and said, this was after you'd been released, which we'll get to, but where he says, you're not victims, you're not this, you're not that, you've gone missing. You know, they couldn't get a hold of you on that. And it's victim blaming. And the way they flip that script to make people really just hate you, it's just disgusting what they did. And for no reason, like there's just no reason why you would do that. They really did put you in so much more danger.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I should have been killed. I should have been killed because of everything that they did. And I mean, that's the sick and twisted part, is that all I had was trusting this man who was holding me captive, decided to follow through with the rapes, decided to hold me the full 48 hours, you know, saying over and over again, you know, you're so strong in the way you're handling this. You don't deserve this. You and Aaron are good people. You know, I had to put my trust in whether or not he was in a place where he was ready to commit murder. And I guess thankfully he wasn't. And my only defense was to show him who I was as a person and try to build a rapport with him, so he wasn't motivated to kill me, and that he hopefully had some kind of compassion still in there, enough to let me go. And he does, and he decides to drive me down to Southern California, 8-9 hours from where he was holding me, and drop me close enough to where I could walk. Cause he said, you know, again, you've been through enough and I want you to be able to get to your family. And I didn't really trust it, and I was hopeful, but that was used against me. It's like, none of this was my choice. I didn't, you know, I didn't do anything except
very
get
elaborate.
Myself out alive.
Yeah.
And all of it was turned against me.
Yeah. And it was quite odd in a way that you were dropped off near the street where you grew up in Huntington Beach. Is that right?
Yeah. Cause he had asked me, you know, in discussing the drop off is what he called it. It was that second day I was in captivity. He said that Aaron had gone to the police. The media is reporting on the kidnapping. He can't release me in the Bay Area where he had taken me from, because it'd be too hot, is what he said, with police looking for me. So he also asked if there was anyone that I could get to when he did release me, that I could walk to. And I told them everyone I knew was in Southern California. And so I told him where I lived, and I told him, you know, we came up with a cross street to where I could still walk to my mom's. My dad lives a mile from my mom. So, and he even said, you know, what if they're up in Vallejo? And I was like, I've got my childhood friends, parents that live nearby. I've got my neighbors I've lived next to for 30 years. I've got my aunt who lives blocks away from my dad. I was like, just like,
you know,
let me go
people.
And I'll fucking figure it out. when he drove off and I peeled the tape off my eyes and walked out of this alley and I saw the cross streets of where I grew up. I couldn't believe it. Nothing felt real. And even though I was released, I never really felt free.
No.
Because there was these looming threats he had before he released me. He said, you know, you're going to have to talk to the police, because Aaron went to the police, and you can tell them everything I told you about the organization, but you can't tell them anything about us, quote unquote, having sex, or anything about any one of us being in the military. Cause he told me that he had been in the military and suffered from PTSD. And so, you know, I just felt, and he said, we'll know what you tell them, and we'll always be watching you, and we know where your family lives. And so I just felt, even though I was free, I was never going to be free, that I was always going to be under the captivity of their threats for the rest of my life. And sure enough, within an hour, I speak to the local police department for over an hour. I tell them everything that happened. I deny the sexual assaults, but I tell them everything about the home invasion and where, you know, the drive and being held captive, and that I thought that this was going to happen again, and that I was afraid of what was going to come out publicly. And then the first interaction I have with the Vallejo detective, Mustard, he says, that essentially he doesn't believe me, that they're going to offer a proffer of agreement for immunity, and whoever takes it will get it. And I mean, right there, I seriously wondered, well, is someone in their group in the police? Is that why they would know what I tell the police or what I don't tell the police? Why am I being immediately doubted before I even have a chance to directly speak to them? It just felt like I was going from one nightmare to the next. And this was just like phase two of the kidnapping.
Yeah. Is that the point where you realize I need to get a lawyer?
Yeah. I even asked about speaking to a lawyer when I was talking to the local police department, because my captor the day before, he had said, you know, if you speak to the police, you should probably get an attorney to protect yourself. And when he had told me that, I was like, why? I mean, I couldn't fathom that, why I would need one. But yeah, especially when they were offering me immunity, and I'm going, immunity from what?
Yeah.
And then I have a cousin who's an attorney and an uncle who was up with my parents in Vallejo, who got on the phone with me, and he's like, they don't believe you. You've already given a statement. You cannot give any more. You need to speak. We need to get you a defense attorney. And that was then what we were spending hours trying to do, trying to figure out the best legal counsel I can get, and then how I'm going to get back up there and figure out what to do.
Yeah. The nightmare just doesn't seem to end. Did the police ever kind of give you any indication as to why they believed that you two would have planned this out and why they thought it was a hoax? Like, because I can't quite figure out why they thought it was that, like what the point was.
Well, they referenced Gone Girl, and they did.
I was going to ask you about
that. They mentioned that to my mom and my brother when I was still in captivity. So my mom and brother went to the police station to listen to the proof of life. And they had said something about Gone Girl. And then they were asking accusatory questions about me and my character to my mom and brother, who were like, why? Like they made it seem like I'd done something wrong.
Yeah.
So it was obvious that they had that theory before I was even released.
Yeah.
And you know, Aaron and I had recently started dating about 8 months or so, and Aaron had just gotten out of a relationship, a long-term relationship with his ex-fiance, because she had cheated on him. And there was a moment a month or so before the kidnapping where I had found text messages that he was reaching out to her again. So I think in their mind, I guess they all went to see the movie Gone Girl and thought, okay, this guy's being shady. So then this girl, me, is trying to get back at him. But then that's where the logic falls apart even with that. Cause it's like, but then they're in on it together, to get fame. I guess that was the other thing.
Yeah. They had told my attorney that they thought we're trying to get like our 15 minutes of fame.
Interesting.
I mean, all of it didn't make, didn't really make sense beyond a surface level, like 2 point of thought.
Yeah.
There's, and they, I mean, both Denise and I were seeing therapists that they could have interviewed that would have told them at any point that none of that makes sense. Denise and I have doctorate degrees. We work in neurological rehab at a well-known center. Denise was applying for an 18-month fellowship. I was finishing like a 4-year training. So we're not only have, dedicate our lives to our profession, like on top of that, we're doing even like more training. Those aren't people like, why would we want to be famous for this? Like, you don't apply for an 18-month fellowship and go like, oh, you know what? Actually, during that time, I don't think YouTube exists. So I'll just try to become a kidnapping thing.
Aaron's brother, who's the FBI agent, I mean, he was like, she grew up in Southern California. I was living in LA for working as a physical therapist right before I moved to Northern California. She was in the area. If she wanted fame or to model or to act or do something, she was in the area to do, like, why would you go up to Vallejo and decide that's when you're going to make it with this whole kidnapping thing? I mean, it
makes no sense. Yeah.
I think it goes back to the Vallejo Police Department has a horrible reputation, horrible reputation.
Yeah.
The FBI agents involved aren't qualified for their position. And I think this goes back to misogyny. I mean, that's probably their best case is that they're misogynistic. I mean, their defense.
That's a nice thing to say about them.
Yeah,
to be honest.
Scenario is that they're just.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of a lot of other words, and that wasn't one. But yeah,
their defense during our civil lawsuit against them was that they weren't malicious; they're just bad at their job. I mean, like that's what their argument boiled down to is like, well, we're just bad.
That's comforting, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's how comforting is that?
Yeah,
but yet they didn't do anything wrong, and based on everything that they had at the time, they made the right choice, and there's no reason to change any protocols or reprimand anyone, you know, I mean,
crazy.
And this happens in high profile cases. There's a higher likelihood of false confessions or a higher likelihood of the police throwing someone under a bus just to get the media off their attention.
Of course.
And that was basically what happened was, you know, they were portraying me as a murderer, and it was clear from the police or the news report that everyone thought I killed Denise, and then she's alive. And so now, understandably, the community is very scared because there's dangerous people out there. Someone broke in, at least a group of people broke into home and took someone in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So now the police have to answer a question, did they actually do anything, which they didn't. So it's easier just to say, we made it up, and then that got the pressure off them and blamed us. And that does happen in these higher profile cases.
Does.
Ours is multiple reasons why it's frustrating. It's like the police made it a high profile case. They're the ones talking to the media. They're the ones who leaked the Gone Girl theory. I'm confident of that. So they expanded all the attention on them, and then they couldn't handle it because Detective Mustard's very bad at his job.
Oh yeah, terrible. Like I said, I've seen some of the interrogation videos, and I'm like, he's just everything that I hate about that type of police work. Like disgusting. Like they're saying they didn't do anything wrong. I'd say they didn't do anything because it doesn't seem like they did anything. And I think it's disgusting. And you're very lucky to be alive because if it was, you just don't know.
Yeah.
How offended were the both of you to hear that Gone Girl label? Because, I mean, I'm offended for you. I just think, like you said, it's like they went and saw that movie and they were like, oh, yeah, that sounds good. We'll take the heat off us. Let's make it a hoax. We'll flip the script. We'll call them the Gone Girl, the real Gone Girl.
I mean, at first, I didn't know what that meant. I was going in for my second day of questioning by the police and the FBI when my attorney said, you know, looking at news reports, they're calling you Gone Girl, the real life Gone Girl. And I said, what does that mean? I hadn't read the book. I hadn't seen the movie. I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until later that I found out what the premise was. And I mean, it was truly the greatest insult of my life. And for no reason, nothing in my life, in my past, in how my relationships would give them reason to think that, other than the little bit of rockiness in our relationship. So it just, you know, it was a lot to struggle with for a long time. And it was actually until I finally watched the movie about 9 months after the kidnapping to see, it kind of gave me some peace around it, I guess, because it didn't matter what I did or said. That was what they thought of me. And that's what they think of women. You know, I was not emotional enough. Yet in the movie, she's like dramatically falling into Ben Affleck's arms when she's, you know, returned. And
there is a big difference, isn't there, between a Hollywood movie and real life?
With a hammer to make it look like she was beaten, and I didn't have any marks on me, so therefore, you know, and I didn't fight back with the rapes and didn't get gruesome internal injuries, so that was a reason they said it didn't exist or I wasn't really raped. And so there was nothing that actually matched what happened in the movie. And it just went to show, it goes to show, like, that's just what they think of women. I mean, and also, you know, later we found out that the chief of police before Kenny Park, the spokesperson, went out to say that it was all a hoax. He told Kenny Park to go out there and burn that bitch. And this chief of police, again, it's like they didn't speak to me at the time. They knew nothing about me. All they knew is that I was a physical therapist working in a neurological rehab unit and that I have family that are coming up who care about me. I have lifelong friends that were on the phone with them. I mean, what was it about me that made them think that I was this gone girl? And it was, again, it was just the greatest insult of my life.
Yeah, it's just disgusting. At what point does the case go from the both of you being accused of staging this and it being a hoax to the police actually investigating it or taking it seriously? Did something happen there? Because then... So they never did. So how did it lead to, because someone got arrested who was already in prison, but how did that happen?
Yeah, so this is part of many tragedies of this, is that bad police work makes the public less safe. So even after they call, you know, say it's a hoax, Denise spends 2 days and all day answering her questions in the hopes of catching these dangerous criminals. Then the police do nothing, despite the kidnappers even sending emails to the Chronicle explain how they did it, more proof that we aren't involved, pictures, which the police then decided that either Denise's lawyer wrote it or I wrote it with the help of my brother. Instead of just actually taking it, maybe it's really the kidnappers did feel remorse at some level. So months are going by and they're doing nothing investigative wise. They're still threatening us with prosecution. They won't return my wallet. They won't return our cars. They won't return. They still have evidence of my, or some of my stuff that they haven't returned. And so we're trying to make us feel like fugitives. And then unfortunately, one of the perpetrators, Matthew Mueller, attacked another family. In a similar fashion, but with some key differences, as we describe in the book. And he leaves his personal cell phone at the crime scene, a different department from Dublin, which is about 40 miles from Vallejo, investigates that, traces his phone call or his phone back to South Lake Tahoe and arrests him for attacking a family in Dublin, which they've gone through their own traumatic event. And during that investigation, Missy Carusu, she was her first day as a detective, her first case as a detective. When she went to South Lake Tahoe, she said the hairs on the back of her neck stood up because she knew something else had happened. And she kept on following the evidence and lead and went above and beyond, and eventually found the car that he had taken Denise in that was actually stolen from Mare Island, where I lived. And then trace that back and connected Mueller to our crime. And that's how he got arrested and how our names were eventually at least somewhat cleared. But there was no investigation by Vallejo or no investigation by the FBI agents involved. It's because one of them attacked again. And unfortunately, we know there's other people involved and they may have already committed other crimes, or they may commit may commit crimes in the future.
Because only one person has been charged, right?
One person, yeah. So one person's caught, and then the same FBI agents who said, "I killed Denise," the same FBI agents who said, "Have you seen the movie Gone Girl?" are telling us that he acted alone, despite us seeing other people, hearing other people. I mean, Mueller is the one they're saying acted alone. Mueller's not a magician. He's not David Copperfield. There's no way he's made this. And Mueller has actually even said there's other people involved now in prison, but they're not going to reopen the case because it's an embarrassing case for them.
I'm wondering, do you think that someone involved is someone that you maybe know? Has that crossed your mind?
We know that there have been consistent that they were targeting my ex. We don't know if there is a connection or he just said that. So we don't know. I mean, we don't get access to the evidence. And from our, you know, brief conversations with these investigators, they had told Denise they're 98% sure that Mueller acted alone. This is even prior to going into any of his electronics. And when we asked them if they had followed up certain leads, they didn't answer or didn't have an answer. So we can't trust the integrity of this. And many victims, we don't have answers to these questions because we're not in charge of actually doing it.
Recently, you've both been offered an apology from the police. Does that apology mean anything to either of you, given how poorly you were treated and just the lack of help they have offered for years now? Does the apology mean anything? Just saving face?
Yeah, not 6 years later. We went through a civil suit against the city and the police department. And again, it was over and over in sworn declarations that they did nothing wrong. Of course, they thought that because, you know, I wasn't acting right as a victim. They never issued an apology then if they were, you know, we reached a settlement and there was no really true, honest acknowledgement of wrongdoing then. So issuing an apology 6 years later when we are releasing a book and speaking publicly about it again and again, it wasn't directly to us. It was to, you know, ABC 2020 or People Magazine or something. So
yeah, and we had reached out, our co-author had reached out for comment when we were writing the book and they said no comment. They give a public apology to ABC 2020 and they've never spoken to us. And the apology doesn't matter. Actions would matter if they made changes. So in 2015, Detective Musker was given Officer of the Year, the same year of the kidnapping, because they want I'm guessing because they want to make him feel better. And he can't be a bad officer if he's their best officer, which unfortunately, not only it just cheapens that, you know, award for actual good officers who deserve it. They had to give it to a guy to save face. Detective Musker has been promoted. He's still an active investigator, even though he's lied and sworn statements in our case, has withheld evidence in other cases. But they continue to use him as their lead detective. And so they continue to show their actions, show what they actually care. Them saying a few words and not making any changes means nothing.
I mean, it's like the kidnappers who, like, the one who held me captive before he released me said, you know, watching what this does to a human being, this isn't what I got into this for. I'm never going to do this again. Like, as if I changed his motivation. And then 2 months later, he's caught for another crime. So, I mean, what's really the most disturbing thing is the similarities between the actions of the kidnappers and the actions and thought process of the police.
Yeah.
And, you know, when Aaron and I were reunited and he told me about what he went through with the police, the isolation, the manipulation, the psychological torture. I mean, I just was like, oh my God, they were doing the exact same thing that was happening to me.
Yeah.
That is the hardest, I think, to sit with. You know that there are evil, quote unquote, evil people out there that are motivated to terrorize people that are just sick and, but you still can sleep at night thinking, okay, well, if something bad happens, I can call 911, I can turn to the police and they will help. And in our case, the opposite was true. They made everything worse. And so it's a very chilling and disturbing new reality, new world to live in.
I do want to point out that as bad as Vallejo police and the FBI was in this case, like, you know, Misty shows how good police work and how dramatically it can change our lives. And mm-hmm. I mean, if they never connected Mueller to our crime, like I don't know where our lives would be. Our jobs were trying to fire us. Like you Google us and it was this horrible, news article after news article. Our reputation was effectively destroyed. So she helped restore that and help protect the public. And so we're eternally grateful for her And so there's a, I mean, our story has the two opposite, polar opposites of it, which is important to note.
Yeah. Like she is the good cop here. She's due diligent and does her work properly and cares about it. The last thing I just wanted to ask you both, and I don't know if you'll have an answer for this, but what, if anything, has this experience taught the both of you about yourselves as individuals and as a couple?
Well, I think a big thing is anytime times get difficult or there's new challenges that we face, in a way, it's like, well, we overcame that, so we can overcome anything. And the fact that we have each other healing and going through our PTSD and trying to have a more or less a normal life with that, you know, deeply inside us, it's really helpful to have a partner who can support you and love you and understand in a way that other people can't. So I think just realizing how resilient and strong we are and can be, especially in those weak moments. That's one.
Yeah. I think for myself, I used to, if I was struggling with stuff, I just kept it to myself. I didn't want to burden people with, you know, my stresses, or even when my ex-fiance had found out about our affair, I kept that pretty private. And now I know that, you know, it's being vulnerable isn't weakness, or finding the right people like Denise, or, you know, therapists or my friends and family to that I can trust and share and talk about is really important, because no one can do it alone. So I think I'm a lot more open to emotionally, and that's been a positive in my life and a positive in our relationship, and something I'm hoping to continue to demonstrate for my daughter or our daughter, that it's not, you don't have to be the kind of quiet, resilient all the time. And it's, you know, it's improved, I guess, lack of a better term, it's improved my emotional intelligence dramatically and empathy dramatically. So,
which is amazing in a way. Like, I know it's not amazing. What you went through is not amazing, but to be able to have that insight and take that away from such a traumatic, well, numerous traumatic events is beautiful. I'm in awe of this story. When I first read it years ago, I was like, what? Like, if you went and saw this at the movies, which I guess is kind of like Gone Girl, you just don't believe that that would ever happen in real life, but it does. And it's scary. And I'm very sorry that you were so mistreated. And that, and I think I read that people are still maybe somewhat accusing you both of like this was all still a hoax. Do some people still believe that?
There's always going to be people.
There is, and there. You know,
it doesn't make it any less difficult to receive.
Yeah,
but you know, and it's definitely few and far between compared to people who do believe in us and support us. But yeah, there's going to always be people who blame us, who don't believe us.
Yeah, they don't matter. They really don't matter. I mean, sitting here talking to you both, and I can see the both of you, and I know this is a podcast, so people won't be able to see your face. I can tell, like, this is real. This story is way too just crazy for it not to be. Or else you've got a really great imagination, but we know that it's real. And yeah. So the book, okay, we better promote the book. The book, Victim F, everyone get it. And is that therapeutic for you both to be able to put your side out there like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. For years we had to stay silent because there was all these pending legal cases and we wanted to do right by that. But it was really one of the most difficult things to watch over and over again, people misreporting, misrepresenting us, even people with the best intentions. You know, as soon as a lie is out there, it's hard to decipher what's truth and what's not. So this was our chance to finally show people, if you were interested to hear about what really happened, this is it. And for our book especially, we wanted to make sure that it was from our perspectives of like what we went through as victims. Because a lot of times in this true crime kind of world and era, the victims are just an afterthought. And, yeah. You know, in our book, we wanted to discuss what it was like to try to restore our lives. Something like this affects every single part of your life and your relationships. And so we wanted to not hide what it's like to try to deal with PTSD and try to move forward. You know, what victims go through, that's part of the case. It's a huge part of the case. So
yeah, absolutely. It doesn't end the moment that you are released by the kidnappers, or, you know, it goes on for years and years and you'll always live with it. Yeah.
I think it's like you'll need to go through a kidnapping or something as extreme as we went through to understand what it's like to recover from a trauma. We try to be as open with our struggles throughout that and how we found a path of healing. I mean, it was important for us to do something positive with something so terrible. And, we're storytellers, and the story that we tell, the most important story we tell is the one we tell ourselves. And we're able to, you know, in a way, take back some of the, because our trauma was hijacked by social media, the police, and that's very difficult to get through. So that was it was very therapeutic for us to write it and hopefully help others. Cause that's what we do as professionals, as physical therapists, is opportunity to maybe help people at a larger scale.
Yeah. And I think that it says a lot about both of you individually as characters, that you have taken something so traumatic and you're using it in a positive way, trying to create change in that. And I think that's really amazing. I really love that when people do that, and I'm sure that's hard at times, but there will be people that will get a lot out of that, and I think that's amazing for you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on and telling your story. It's extremely powerful, and I just wish there was change there that's a bit more comforting, and that those police officers and all that actually had some consequences to their actions. So, yeah, thank you so much. I really do appreciate you coming on here and talking about this.
Yeah, thanks
for your interest. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll put links to the book, and, you know, people really need to read this. Hopefully people can learn what it's like to have a bit of empathy. Thank you so much for coming on, and you've been very kind. I've gone a bit over what I asked from you. So, yeah, I'll let you guys go, but thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening. So until next time, be the change the world needs. But for now, school's out, class dismissed.